Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are taking on a source that is, well, it's historically dense, deeply personal, and frankly very difficult to confront.
It really is.
We're talking about the codification of 19th century racial views within the foundational scriptures of the LDS Church. We're digging into historical analysis that just breaks this history down with almost clinical precision.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at how the cultural prejudices of early America didn't just, you know, exist outside the church, but were written directly into what millions hold as sacred truth.
This is undoubtedly challenging material. I mean, it forces us to confront some really uncomfortable truths.
Absolutely.
So we have to approach it with, I think, both scholarly rigor and a profound sense of empathy, understanding the pain that's inherent in these teachings for generations of people.
Right.
Our mission today is clear. We're here to decompose and distill the detailed analysis provided by our sources, focusing purely on the source texts and the surrounding historical context that historians and critics alike have provided.
So we're not passing judgment on belief.
Not at all. We are here to meticulously examine the evidence that connects that 19th century ideology to modern truth claims. That's the goal.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Our sources, they focus on three key texts, the Book of Mormon, the Book of Moses, and the Book of Abraham. And they use these to map how specific 19th century American racial ideologies found their way into the canon.
It's really a story about the transfer of cultural assumptions.
Exactly. It's not just about, you know, general societal issues like slavery being present in the background. This is about specific, explicit, written down doctrinal assertions.
Assertions about skin color, about lineage, about divine favor.
All being cemented as eternal truth.
Exactly. We are connecting the dots between contemporary American thought, especially what was prevalent in the 1830s frontier environment where Joseph Smith was operating, and the modern claims of unchanging ancient truth.
So it's not just what was written.
No, it's why it fits the time period so perfectly. And crucially, how it provided this ready-made theological justification for the racial hierarchies of the day.
Understanding that is essential for anyone who wants a thorough, informed view of this history.
It really is. We need to see the precise mechanism, you know, by which local prejudice became, in effect, global and eternal canon.
Okay, let's start right where the foundational narrative begins.
Mm-hmm.
The Book of Mormon and the context of the early 1800s in the United States.
It's the only place to start.
Because it's impossible to analyze these texts in a vacuum.
Yes.
You mentioned the 1830s context. That's just, it's so crucial. Even faithful scholars.
Uh-huh. People who are actively supporting the church.
Right, like the prominent historian Richard Bushman, or even secular biblical scholars like Dan McClellan. They all agree that the Book of Mormon is best understood as a 19th century text. So why is that specific historical reflection so important for our discussion today?
Well, it's important because it provides the theological motivation, but that 19th century environment also provides the crucial political and economic motivation.
Ah.
Think about it. For white settlers expanding westward, taking possession of new territory was a relentless, often violent undertaking.
Of course.
So there was this intense social and religious need for a justification, a reason for taking land from those who were already here, the indigenous people.
They were often referred to in the discourse of the time as.
As dark-skinned people already in America.
Yeah.
And if this land was divinely appointed to the white settlers, then the indigenous presence required a specific and, frankly, a negative theological explanation for why they were there and why they, quote, deserved to lose their land.
And that explanation, which was just prevalent in the culture surrounding Joseph Smith, was known as the Mound Builder Myth.
Yes.
And this is key. This wasn't something Joseph Smith invented out of whole cloth. It was a widespread, popular theory at the time. Can you detail exactly what this myth claimed?
Yeah.
And why it was such a powerful ideological tool for colonization?
Certainly. The Mound Builder Myth was this pervasive non-Mormon theory that really captivated the American imagination in the early 1800s.
So it was already out there.
Oh, absolutely. Across the Ohio Valley and other parts of the continent, these massive earth mounds were being discovered. And contemporary archaeology, you know, it couldn't easily explain their origin to the satisfaction of the white settlers.
So they came up with their own story.
They did. The prevailing theory, long before the Book of Mormon ever appeared, suggested that the current inhabitants, the dark-skinned savage people, which was their term for Native Americans, were only present in America because they had violently murdered a previous technologically superior, and this is the crucial part, an ancient superior white race.
A white race that had built those mounds.
Precisely.
That's fascinating. So the myth served this dual, incredibly powerful purpose. First, it goes Native Americans this horrific genocidal origin story.
Right. It implied they were inherently violent and responsible for wiping out a superior civilization.
And second, maybe more practically for the settlers, it handed them the moral justification to take the land back.
Exactly. They weren't conquering. In their minds, they were acting as righteous avengers.
Restoring the land to its rightful superior hands.
Which were implicitly their own hands. Those of European descent. It's a perfect justification.
And this ideological landscape, this idea of dark-skinned indigenous people as cursed murderers of a pure white civilization, it leads directly to the narrative framework we see codified in 2 Nephi 5.
It does. This chapter attempts to provide that exact origin story for the indigenous people within the Book of Mormon's narrative, but it filters it through the precise lens of 19th century race theory.
And it uses language that is just. It's unambiguous. Let's look at the key verses in 2 Nephi 5 that detail this Lamanite curse.
Okay.
The text states that a sore cursing came upon the Lamanites because of their iniquity, specifically because they had hardened their hearts against him and rebelled against the righteous white Nephites.
And the consequences are stated in the plainest possible terms. Prior to this curse, the Lamanites were described as being white and exceedingly fair and delightsome.
So they were white originally.
According to the text, yes. But because of their rebellion, God caused a skin of blackness to come upon them.
And crucially, the text provides the reason for this skin change.
It does. It says, it was so that they might not be enticing to the Nephites, who were the righteous, light-skinned group. It's an explicit statement. Dark skin is a preventative physical barrier designed by God to stop interracial mixing.
And here's where it gets really interesting and really problematic, because the repugnant nature of this curse is amplified by the fact that it explicitly extends across generations.
Yes, it creates a major theological crisis.
The text warns, and I'm quoting here, "Cursed shall be the seed of him that mixes with their seed, for they shall be cursed even with the same cursing."
That phrase, the curse extending to the seed, is a huge theological problem that, you know, often goes unaddressed. Think about the foundational articles of faith in the LDS Church.
Number two.
Right. It states clearly that people will not be punished for Adam's transgression. That is a core principle of individual accountability.
But not here.
Not here. Here, in foundational scripture, you have an explicit doctrine of inherited intergenerational guilt. People being punished indefinitely across centuries for their ancestors' iniquities.
It fundamentally undermines the entire premise of individual accountability that the church otherwise promotes. I mean, if one of the earliest divine acts in the Book of Mormon is the imposition of a collective, permanent punishment that passes down through the bloodline,
affecting people's appearance and their eternal standing,
it suggests a capricious, vengeful God who operates by rules that are just fundamentally contradictory to the rest of the restored gospel.
And yet that intergenerational punishment, while it's doctrinally messy, it perfectly served the 19th century colonial need to justify racial separation and exclusion.
Right. The leaders who read this text never question that premise.
Of course not, because it validated their existing cultural assumptions about race.
Which brings us to the analysis of the text itself, because modern apologists often try to clean this up. They try to separate the curse from the skin of blackness.
The great spiritualizing attempt.
Right. They argue the curse is merely spiritual being cut off from God's presence, and that the dark skin color is just a sign or a mark of that spiritual curse, not the curse itself. They say, oh, it's a metaphor.
Well, that separation is a convenient modern reading. It's an attempt to make an 1830s text palatable for the 21st century. But it's entirely contradicted by the plain text of the scriptures themselves.
We don't have to guess.
No, we don't have to guess at the relationship between the skin and the curse. If you look at Alma chapter 3, the text states plainly, quote, "The skins of the Lamanites were dark according to the mark which was set upon their fathers, which was a curse upon them."
Which was a curse upon them.
It connects the dark skin and the curse inextricably. The skin is described as the mark, and the mark is described as the curse. To claim they're separate requires you to just redefine the actual words written in the scripture.
And Jacob 3 just reinforces this point. It makes the curse, the skin, and the repugnance synonymous. It all ties back to that initial goal of preventing intermarriage.
Right. It confirms dark skin as part of the curse, stating Lamanites are hated because of their filthiness and their cursing, which has come upon their skins.
So God used skin color explicitly to make them unattractive to the white Nephites to prevent mixing. The text even says the Lamanites are loathsome due to the appearance of their skin.
This is the central problem of the text's enduring presence in the canon. The historical record shows that Joseph Smith, Orson Pratt, Brigham Young. I mean, virtually every early leader read this literally. Skin meant skin.
And this text remains in the Book of Mormon today. Until 1981, it explicitly promised that Lamanites would become white and delightsome upon conversion.
The implications of that literal reading are just devastating for people whose skin color aligns with the curse.
And we have direct evidence of this literal interpretation being applied to policy, which shows this wasn't just some abstract mythology. The concept of dark skin as a physical curse, directly connected to the fear of racial mixing, became the foundation for early leader teachings against interracial marriage.
It did, and this went far beyond just a general distaste.
This was canonized prejudice.
It was. The policy was based on the scriptural belief that a white person mixing seed would partake of the curse. This led to explicit written policy statements against intermarriage, which were still present in church manuals well into the modern era, you know, deep into the mid-20th century.
So while the church later shifted the argument to say, you know, you shouldn't marry outside your race because it makes life more difficult.
Right, the cultural argument.
The underlying reason, the engine driving that advice, was the foundational scripture that cursed the mixing of seeds.
That shift from don't mix seeds or you'll be cursed to don't mix races because it's hard is a prime example of the church attempting to distance itself from the original, unpalatable scriptural truth.
But without actually removing the text that caused the problem in the first place.
Exactly. They're trying to preserve the scriptural foundation while softening the moral implications for a modern audience.
Okay, building on that, Section 1 dealt primarily with the Native American origin story, the curse of the Lamanites, providing that rationale for territorial expansion.
Yep, right.
But Joseph Smith's revelations had to address another crucial racial group, one foundational to 19th century American society. People of African descent.
Yes. And the rationale for this exclusion was grafted onto the biblical narratives using the highly controversial curses of Cain and Ham.
That transition is absolutely key. It links two separate racial justifications under Joseph Smith's authority using two different sets of scripture.
It shows how he utilized the prevailing 19th century theories to provide divine explanations for both the indigenous population and people of African descent, and then wove them seamlessly into his theological framework.
It's a complete system.
Precisely. So let's look at the Book of Moses first. This is part of the Joseph Smith translation, the JST, which Joseph Smith claimed was a divinely commissioned restoration of biblical material offering expanded revelation.
And it's through the Book of Moses that explicit racism regarding the African curse is introduced into the biblical narrative.
A concept notably absent from the traditional King James Bible.
And we should clarify for you, the listener, why the JST is so important here. It's not just a different translation. It's Smith actively adding new, racially charged material under the guise of restoring ancient lost truth.
That's exactly right. The traditional Bible speaks of Cain receiving a mark after killing Abel, but it never, ever specifies what that mark was. Historical biblical scholarship confirms the traditional text never identified this mark as dark skin.
But Joseph Smith did.
He cemented this 19th century American folklore, a common justification for slavery, into the LDS scriptural canon. Moses 7.8 reads, "A blackness came upon all the children of Canaan, which resulted in them being despised among all people."
Then there's Moses 7.22,
which states explicitly, "The seed of Cain were black and had not placed among them."
It's just astonishing that this idea that black skin is the literal mark of Cain, signifying a cursed lineage that was denied a place, which was often interpreted as a place among the righteous or in the priesthood.
That this idea came into scripture via Joseph Smith, who claimed it was pure, unadulterated, ancient text.
It perfectly justifies the institution of slavery, which was, you know, thriving in America at that time.
It perfectly aligns with the 19th century American need to justify racial hierarchy, slavery, and the denial of fundamental human rights. If God had already cursed an entire lineage to a state of perpetual darkness and exclusion, well,
it simplifies the ethical dilemma.
It really does. It simplifies the ethical dilemma of slavery and systemic racism for the early church. Joseph Smith was not rising above his contemporary culture here. He was reflecting and canonizing its prejudices.
And then this priesthood exclusion is further reinforced and cemented using the curse of Ham in the Book of Abraham.
Yes.
This revelation, allegedly translated from Egyptian papyri, is used to provide a specific scriptural reason for excluding black individuals from the highest blessings of the temple and the priesthood.
The primary scriptural source here is Abraham 1.24. It speaks of the Pharaoh being of a specific lineage from Ham by which he could not have the right of priesthood. it states this explicitly, it cements the priesthood ban into scripture.
So the text claims this lineage descended from Ham and was associated with the cursed race that preserved the curse in the land.
That's the scriptural foundation. That's the doctrine that was used to justify over a century of racial exclusion from both the priesthood and temple ordinances.
Now, the reliance on this 19th century ideology to translate the Book of Abraham is startlingly evident when we examine the facsimiles, the images included with the text.
Oh, yes.
The source material highlights facsimile 3, figure 6, which Joseph Smith translated as Shulam, a slave.
And this is a classic aha moment for historical analysis. The real secular translation of that Egyptian figure based on Egyptological consensus is Anubis, the guide of the dead.
Who is traditionally depicted with the head of a jackal or a dog.
Right. So Joseph Smith looks at this black figure, and Anubis is often depicted as black, which is associated with fertile Nile mud and embalming. And he translates it not as a deity, but as Shulam, a slave.
That's just a definitive example of cultural assumptions directly influencing a supposed divine translation. Black equals slave.
But it goes deeper than a simple mistranslation. This is the part that, you know, you almost have to visualize. We're talking about a potential alteration to the printing plate itself.
Can you walk us through that?
Yes, this is critical. Researchers have observed that the original woodcut plate that was used to print the facsimile, it seems to have been physically modified.
How so?
Specifically, the snout features of Anubis, the jackal head, they appear to have been chiseled off or dramatically altered on the printing plate.
Why would they do that?
Well, this modification would have made the figure look significantly more human, which would then fit the translation of a black slave instead of the Egyptian deity Anubis.
Wow. So that illustrates a potential willingness to manipulate the source material itself, the papyri or the subsequent woodcut plate, just to align with a 19th century racial narrative.
A narrative that says a prominent black figure, even in an ancient text, should be interpreted as a slave, fitting the narrative of the cursed lineage of Ham.
It just demonstrates the enormous power of the surrounding cultural assumptions.
It does. The belief that black skin indicated a cursed servant status was so strong that it either drove the mistranslation of the figure or it led to the physical alteration of the depiction to ensure it supported the theological narrative required at the time.
Which just dramatically undermines any claim that the translation process was pure or devoid of contemporary racial influence.
Completely.
Okay, moving forward in time, we have to address how the church interpreted these scriptures for over a century. We've mentioned that modern apologists try to spiritualize the language.
Right. Darkness meant spiritual darkness or ignorance.
But the historical evidence, right up into the 1970s, it shows unequivocally that for church leaders, skin meant skin.
Absolutely. The visual evidence presented by the church itself confirms this literal reading. We see this in the media aimed at children and new converts.
Like the children's books.
Exactly. Early church published art, like the Book of Mormon stories for children, which were approved by the correlation department, they consistently depicted the Lamanites with literal dark skins, visually resembling Native Americans.
They taught their own children that the curse was a visible difference in pigment.
Yes. This directly refutes any modern attempt to say the term skin of blackness was purely metaphorical. When the church is producing illustrations in the 1970s and earlier, showing indigenous Americans with dark skins and captions confirming they are Lamanites marked by the Lord, there is zero ambiguity about the historical teaching.
The curse was meant to be seen.
And that belief system continued deep into the 20th century, reaching the very highest levels of prophetic authority. We see this so painfully illustrated in the teachings regarding literal color change upon conversion.
The so-called whitening of the Lamanites.
Exactly.
We have to focus on the really jarring example of Spencer W. Kimball's 1960 General Conference address. This wasn't some minor regional leader.
No, this was a future prophet of the church.
Speaking from the pulpit to a worldwide audience, explicitly linking spiritual righteousness to physical skin lightening among Lamanites. Can you give us a sense of the language he used?
Kimball was completely emphatic about this literal process. He stated that the Lamanites are now becoming white and delightsome, explicitly referencing the changed scripture that existed at that time.
And he cited specific instances.
He did, particularly children in the Indian Student Placement Program, where Native American children would live temporarily with white Mormon families as proof that the promise was being fulfilled.
And he didn't just generally reference it, did he? He gave a specific, highly detailed anecdote to prove his point.
He did. It's quite something. He He described witnessing a little member girl sitting between her dark father and the mother, and explicitly noting that the girl was several shades lighter than her parents on the same reservation in the same hogan, subject to the same sun and wind and weather.
And his conclusion.
His conclusion, speaking as a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, was explicit. She was lighter because of her association with the church and the gospel of Christ.
And the anecdote gets even more jarring, including a joke that reveals the extent of this literal belief.
It does. He shared the anecdote of an elder joking about it, claiming that he and his companion were donating blood regularly to the hospital in the hope that the process might be accelerated.
That's astonishing.
That moment, a prophet relating a joke that centers around the physical, biological expectation that blood transfusions could accelerate the removal of a divine curse, it speaks volumes about the pervasive, literal belief in pigment change. This wasn't some historical outlier. This was doctrine delivered from the pulpit.
It shows that the entire organization, up to the highest level, was celebrating and expecting a physical biological transformation based on scriptural promises. If the curse was only spiritual darkness, none of this would make any sense.
None of it.
This teaching that faithfulness leads to lighter skin, it must have caused immense psychological harm, creating this internal pressure, particularly for indigenous youth, to feel shame over their own appearance and to actively seek a physical change.
And beyond the pigment, these racist scriptural beliefs cemented the official policy of exclusion. So let's look at the prophetic statements that define the nature of the ban, particularly the crucial 1947 First Presidency letter.
That letter, signed by President George Albert Smith and his counselors, is pivotal. It was addressing the increasing discomfort with the ban after World War II and the beginnings of the civil rights movement, and it explicitly defined the church's position.
And it is so critical because it explicitly called the priesthood and temple ban the doctrine of the church never questioned by any of the church leaders.
That's a signed official document from the highest governing body of the faith.
It is. And this directly undermines modern efforts to label the ban as merely policy or the opinions of men. It was defined as doctrine by the First Presidency itself.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, today? You have past prophets in signed First Presidency statements explicitly calling the priesthood and temple ban doctrine.
They also condemned interracial marriage in the same document as most repugnant to most normal-minded people.
So it highlights the difficulty, the absurdity, even of current church leaders attempting to distinguish between policy and doctrine today, claiming the ban was just an opinion when past prophets explicitly called it doctrine and official signed correspondence.
It creates a massive dilemma regarding the nature of prophetic authority. Either these men were speaking as the voice of God, defining eternal doctrine for decades, or
they were merely institutional figureheads, unable to distinguish their personal cultural prejudices, which had been codified into scripture by their founder, from divine will.
The 1947 letter leaves no space for the gray area the church tries to occupy today.
And we have to emphasize, the ban was far more than just denying the priesthood to men. Because the priesthood is required for temple ordinances, it was effectively a ban on exaltation.
The ability to receive saving ordinances like temple marriage and sealing,
which, in Mormon cosmology, is required for eternal family unity and full godhood. This was eternal exclusion.
And the story of Jane Manning James exemplifies the full, devastating scope of this exclusion.
She was one of the most faithful early black converts.
Walked all the way from New York to Utah to follow the church leaders, yet she was denied sealing to her husband and children. When she sought to be sealed to Joseph Smith's family, which was the ultimate act of devotion,
the church only allowed her to be attached as a servitor, a servant for eternity, to his family.
To be denied full exaltation, the ultimate goal, and instead be codified as an eternal servant. That's not just policy exclusion, that is the institutionalization of eternal racism.
Reducing her celestial status to that of a slave or domestic help.
And to compound the cruelty, a white proxy had to perform the sealing ordinance on her behalf in the temple. She was denied the exaltation ritual and couldn't even stand in the temple for the ceremony herself.
It's the ultimate spiritual contradiction. They celebrated her faithfulness as a pioneer,
while simultaneously imposing the cruelest, most exclusionary policy rooted directly in scriptural racism, the Book of Abraham's slave translation of Shulam, and the curse narrative manifested in the denial of the most sacred promises of the faith.
She was a living monument to the hypocrisy created by codified 19th century prejudice.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So the church eventually had to reckon with this moral incompatibility, right? The conflict between the written word and social morality became unsustainable.
It did. But rather than admitting the error lay in the original texts, the church chose what we call whitewashing the text,
which involved quiet, often subtle, changes, mainly to the introductory chapter headings of the Book of Mormon.
Right, to soften the racist language while leaving the problematic verses intact. And this action is so revealing. It demonstrates that the church knew the text was problematic, but it resisted the seismic theological implications of changing the actual divinely revealed scriptural verses.
Can you detail the nature of those changes?
Yeah.
How they attempted to spiritualize the meaning through editing?
Certainly. Take 2, Nephi 5. The chapter heading was changed around 2010. It originally referenced a skin of blackness explicitly.
And that was changed.
It was changed to the much more palatable cut off from the presence of the Lord. The church tried to shift the focus from a physical characteristic to a spiritual state.
And Mormon 5.
Similarly, in Mormon 5, the heading previously referred to the Lamanites as a dark, filthy, and loathsome people. This harsh language was scrubbed and changed to reflect only that they would be scattered and the Spirit will cease to strive with them.
So they're using the heading, the contextual summary, as a defense mechanism. They're trying to redirect the reader's attention away from the offensive language that's still contained within the actual verses, which they dare not touch.
Exactly. And most famously, the actual scriptural verse concerning the Lamanite future was changed in 1981, 3 years after the priesthood ban lift.
Right. White and delightsome.
The text that originally read that the Lamanites would become white and delightsome was changed to pure and delightsome.
This change attempts to spiritualize the meaning, but it leaves this lingering, unanswerable question. Why would a divine ancient translation need a politically convenient edit 150 years later? If the text was perfect, why was it changed?
And the attempts to hide this historical reality and the leaders' literal beliefs continued right into the modern era, resulting in the major 2020 Come Follow Me manual controversy.
This was a huge disconnect for members.
A huge one. When the manual was released, the printed version included a quote from Joseph Fielding Smith linking dark skin to the curse. But when the subsequent outcry occurred, it forced the church to review the extent of their historical editing and omission practices.
Often using ellipses to cut out key offensive phrases.
And this is the crucial detail here, the extent of the ellipses in editing. The church omitted Smith's full quote, which discussed dark pigment and the removal of the curse leading to lighter skin.
So by omitting those specific references to pigment and literal lightness, the church effectively deceived members about the historical context and the leaders' literal beliefs regarding skin color.
That full quote, had it been included, would have unequivocally proven to modern members that prophets believed skin color was literal, tied to pigment, and could physically change upon conversion. They removed the very language that tied the racist doctrine to the body, engaging in outright deception to maintain the facade that the ban was only rooted in spiritual darkness.
Which brings us to perhaps the most significant moment of retreat and course correction. The 1978 priesthood ban lift.
Right.
The narrative, often taught, is the familiar one of a grand revelation, as described by leaders like Gordon B. Hinckley.
Yeah.
A hallowed, sanctified moment where a conduit opened between heaven and the kneeling prophet.
And that narrative, while it's powerful for faith building, it stands in stark contrast to the historical reality documented in primary sources.
Such as the candid LeGrand Richards interview transcript.
Exactly. Richards, who was an apostle at the time, described the impetus for the ban lift as entirely practical and financial, not as a spontaneous, urgent, divine command.
The problem was a literal building and a financial imperative. The church had built a temple in São Paulo, Brazil.
And due to Brazil's racial history, much of the population had Negro blood. They had raised money for the temple, but according to the standing No Drop of Black Blood policy, most of the local converts couldn't be sealed or receive ordinances.
So the church needed to ensure attendance and use of the temple to justify the massive costs.
The pressure was enormous, both financially and socially. It was untenable to have a massive, expensive building that the local faithful population couldn't use.
So Richard's description of the revelation is incredibly revealing.
It is. He describes it not as a spontaneous divine voice, but as a series of meetings, individual interviews with the prophet, and a document that was drafted, edited, and crucially voted on by the apostles.
And you mentioned a fascinating piece of political maneuvering regarding that vote.
Yes. Richards explicitly noted that Apostle Mark Peterson, who was perhaps the most vocal and fierce opponent of the ban lift, was conveniently out of town when the final decision was reached and ratified.
Which strongly suggests the revelation was actually a corporate consensus.
Reached through careful political maneuvering, intense social pressure from the civil rights era, and the pressing financial necessity of the Brazil temple. The dramatic, kneeling prophet narrative is the clean, PR-friendly replacement for a difficult, practical corporate decision.
This just raises a fundamental question. If the prophets truly are continuous conduits of divine will, why did it take 120 years of intense, externally generated social pressure and a looming financial crisis in Brazil to finally overturn a doctrine that was rooted in explicitly racist 19th century assumptions?
Why did God not reveal the policy change during the height of the civil rights movement or during the horrific history of slavery itself?
It's the ultimate crisis of discernment.
It is. The failure of prophetic leadership for over 120 years suggests these leaders could not distinguish between their personal 19th century cultural prejudices, prejudices codified into scripture by Joseph Smith, and the actual loving will of God.
The timeline was dictated by external social forces and financial needs, not by divine command.
Which dramatically undercuts the concept of continuous, guiding, proactive revelation.
And if prophets are unleashed, to use Wendy Nelson's quote about Russell Nelson, to follow through on personal concerns, only when they reach the top position and the votes are secured.
It raises a major question about the nature of modern revelation.
Is it a conduit to the divine? Or is it simply the ability of the leader to finally secure consensus on their personal progressive agenda?
The historical evidence regarding race in the foundational texts and policies leans heavily toward the latter. The structure of the church appears to prioritize institutional inertia, political consensus, and avoiding financial or public relations crises over spontaneous, uncomfortable, or socially inconvenient divine instruction. The doctrine only changed when the world made it impossible to maintain the old policy.
We've completed a demanding deep dive. We've distilled how pervasive 19th century American views, specifically the mound builder myth, the curse of Cain, and the curse of Ham, were not just present in the culture, but were literally codified into the foundational texts of the LDS Church.
And this led to decades of explicitly racist policy and doctrine, all defined by the highest leaders.
The data shows a recurring, undeniable pattern. When the scriptures or doctrines faced an incompatibility with scientific reality like DNA evidence contradicting the Lamanite origins claim, or with social morality,
the church consistently chose the path of least resistance,
which meant editing chapter headings, altering the word white, and eventually changing policy rather than overturning the original problematic scriptural verses.
And this highlights the weight and the immovability of those original problematic words in the LDS canon. They are foundational, and therefore they can't be removed without shattering the entire truth claim structure.
So consider the historical context one last time. If the foundational texts of the church were written to align perfectly and explicitly with the prejudices and scientific understandings of 1830s America, not rising above them, but reflecting and canonizing them, what does that imply about the source of those texts?
It raises the profound question that every serious learner must confront. Do these scriptures represent an ancient, pure revelation from God, or do they represent a religious narrative generated by a man who was deeply and inescapably influenced by the cultural and racial milieu of the 19th century frontier?
That is heavy. We encourage you to engage with this history, discuss it openly, and use this knowledge as the foundation for your own continued understanding of how foundational religious texts interact with the history and morality of their time. Thank you for joining us on this difficult but vital deep dive. We'll see you next time.